Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Today, we're starting a new program segment, World Watch. Our international news summary focuses primarily on conflicts and catastrophes that journalists across the seven continents are covering. In North Africa, much of Egypt remains in a state of emergency, 1 week after deadly rioting broke out in a port city. More than 50 Egyptians have died in street protests, which came around the second anniversary of the uprising that toppled Hosni Mubarak. The Egyptian army chief warned that the state was on the brink of collapse, but the daily curfew was shortened Wednesday as violence eased. Both President Mohamed Morsi and the opposition leadership called for a national dialogue to resolve the political crisis. And today, feuding politicians met face-to-face and renounced violence. To the east in Mali, French and Malian troops seized Timbuktu in a fight against Islamic militants. They've seized much of the northern territory, and Britain promised to deploy military personnel to support the French. The United States is providing aerial surveillance, and for its part, the European Union is planning a military training mission for the region. Across the Mediterranean Sea, fighting between the Syrian rebels and the army of Bashar al-Assad intensified in Damascus, and journalists report that at least 65 young people were summarily executed in the city of Aleppo. Also inside Syria, the military has confirmed that Israeli jets carried out an airstrike on its territory. But the military denied reports that trucks carrying weapons bound for Lebanon were the targets. In another war-torn region, Pakistan may soon be responsible for the training of Afghanistan's armed forces. That development follows a meeting of the Afghan defense minister and Pakistan's military leader. Meanwhile, North Korea is shaking its fist at the world again this week. Pyongyang is angry at the United Nations for toughening sanctions as punishment for its long-range missile firing into orbit in December. North Korea also threatened to attack South Korea if its neighbor goes along with the sanctions. The communist nation then vowed to test a nuclear device and fire more test missiles toward the United States. But at least we can now all get a good look inside the Hermit Kingdom. Google this week unveiled detailed maps of North Korea. The maps were created with the help of citizen cartographers and years of crowdsourcing. They point out spots as small as stores and as large as North Korea's gulags, some the size of cities. On the disaster front, major flooding in Mozambique has displaced about 150,000 people and killed nearly 40 residents. The United Nations reports that the flooding has also hit South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. A crocodile farm in the north of South Africa was forced to open its gates because of the flooding. Workers managed to round up a few thousand of the creatures, but more than 10,000 crocodiles are still on the loose. Listen again next week when we'll have another roundup of international news. Now, we'll move on to the topic of the day, the elections in Israel and Jordan. Global Journalist producer Mikkel Christensen has this summary of political developments in Israel.
In the election held last week, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party received the most votes, which in all likelihood will secure him another term as Prime Minister. But the election was far from a complete triumph for Netanyahu. His party, Likud, lost more than 25% of the seats in Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Now Netanyahu has to attempt to form a coalition among the 12 parties that got elected. Earlier he has based his support on the right-wing parties, but this time he may have to move towards the middle. Because the big winners of the election were the centrist party Yesh Atid, who surprised everybody and received the second most votes. The party campaigned mostly on domestic issues. They're devoted to helping the middle class and wanting to stop the military draft exemptions for the ultra-Orthodox civilians. The election was unusual as surveys showed that Israeli voters did not consider security politics the most important topic in the campaign, and this might explain the success of the centrist parties.
Israeli President Shimon Peres received the official election results Wednesday, and now will formally ask Netanyahu to form another cabinet. It's a process that usually takes weeks. Our first guest on Global Journalist will give us an insider's view of political developments in Israel. Glenys Sugarman is the executive secretary of Israel's Foreign Press Association, and she also worked for 25 years as a radio correspondent at a variety of stations in Africa. Glenys, from an outsider's perspective, the main issues in Israel seem to always relate to security, of war and peace. But that wasn't the case this time. So why did so many voters move toward parties such as the Yesh Atid?
Well, I think the problem is a question of Israel's financial state for young people, for the upper middle class, the middle class, the working classes. They feel that they have been carrying a very heavy burden for very many years now. The Israeli governments, various coalition governments over the years, have given an increased share of the public pie, as it were, to the religious parties and mm-hmm. religious sectors who actually contribute nothing to the economy. As far as security is concerned, Israelis know that that is item number one. It's untouchable, and every government will first take care of security and then everything else. But they're waiting for the everything else as well. Young people today want to live comfortable lives. They want to have housing. They want to feel that they are not the only ones bearing the brunt of military service and the economy.
And so what are some of the reasons that Netanyahu lost support? What was it about his message that did not resonate?
I think this was basically it, that the very right wing decided Netanyahu was wavering. He was not right wing enough. There is tremendous unrest in the area around us, in Syria, in Lebanon. Jordan is still stable, but the only one. Cairo is definitely not what it was supposed to be with the Arab Spring, and there's still Iraq. So that the very right wing decided that Netanyahu was not playing the game. This was the time that the international community could be ignored, and he should get on with clearing out vast areas of the West Bank. The middle class, as it were, the working class people, were pulled towards Yesh Atid, this is Yair Lapid, the former anchorman's party, because he has younger appeal. And the young people basically want what he is offering. He's not talking about a separation of religion and state, because religion is still big in terms of the fact, not religion, not Orthodox religion per se, but the fact that the Israelis want to know that this is a Jewish state. Yair Lapid also pushed the idea that the religious groups that are becoming a very, very large sector of the population have got to start doing military service like everybody else in the country. And this appeals to the young Israeli, most certainly, so that the votes bled, as it were, from the Likud towards Yair Lapid, who is not exactly a left winger, and he's a centrist, leaning towards the right. And on the other side of it, the far more right, under the leadership of a gentleman by the name of Naftali Bennett.
Right.
He certainly called the shots in terms of the right wingers.
Now, from our perspective, with our two party politics, we sometimes have a hard time understanding how diverse the politics there in Israel is. Can you give us just a real quick idea about how diverse the political spectrum is in Israel, and how more of those diverse populations get a get a seat in Parliament?
The idea of this proportional representation system was started by the Zionist Congress 60 years ago, and what they wanted was to make sure that all of these various minority groups would have some sort of representation, including, by the way, four Arab parties, mm-hmm. who never quite make it into a coalition, but they still, the Arab population still prefers to vote for Arab Knesset members, for Arab members of parliament. And they certainly have an interesting variety. Right. Then there are two or three religious parties, again, separate, because they don't really all agree with one another. Some are more orthodox than the others. And then you have a selection of right-wingers, a selection of left-wingers. And this last election was unbelievable because there were 30 or 34 lists running for the Knesset.
Wow. And now... There's a coalition must form. That's why it takes so long to get it together. Now, in the United States, there's a perception that the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu is somewhat cold. Will this election have changed anything in that regard?
I like your description of somewhat cold. Unless you're a government spokesman who keeps informing everybody that, of course, the relationship is strong and, of course, everybody respects everybody else, I think it's very clear to any observer that Netanyahu certainly tried to meddle in the American elections, and Mr. Obama returned the favor now in these elections, so that there's no love lost between these two leaders. On the other hand, yes, there is cooperation on other levels of government, certainly when it comes to information exchanges about international terror and that kind of thing. So, but the two leaders do not like one another. This is very clear.
Now, briefly, the parties that focused on the Palestinian issues didn't fare so well, but. How would you characterize the impact of this election on the opportunity for a two-state solution and Middle East peace?
Quite honestly, it looks sick, because there was only one party, and this was set up just 2 months before the election itself by a former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Tzipi Livni. And she didn't really talk about it, you know, a proper peace agreement, but just to get the process started again. Now, because Netanyahu will probably want a broad-based, stable government, which is what he always likes. He likes far more than the 61 Knesset members that he would have to have for an ordinary coalition. He may very well bring Tzipi Livni into the government, and he may make her happy and give her the mandate of starting some or other process again with the Palestinian Authority. But on the whole, this does not look very, very good. And if Netanyahu does bring in the rightist party of Mr. Bennett, Bennett has no interest whatsoever in any kind of agreement with the Palestinians. He wants to annex large portions, if not all, of the West Bank.
All right. Well, I'm sure...
So this does not look good.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we're all eager to see how this plays out in the coming weeks. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today, Glenys.
And thank you.
Okay. Now, before we begin the second segment of our program on the elections in neighboring Jordan, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at Global Jorn. That's Global J-O-U-R-N. 2-1. Wayne White is a scholar with the Middle East Institute. He focuses on the Near East and South Asia. White is also the former deputy director of the State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office. Wayne, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
Now, the Jordan has held elections for more than 80 years, but the parliamentary election last week was exceptional. Jordan's monarchy calls the election a watershed moment in the kingdom's democratization. So, Wayne, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, no, really, because the king and the government tried to make it a more of a watershed by trying to get larger inclusiveness. But what in fact happened was that most of the Islamists in Jordan boycotted the election. And there's a good reason for that.
Yeah,
and that is that the monarchy is engaged in quite a lot of gerrymandering, which has heightened the importance of rural districts where the major support of the regime lies with the tribe, and minimize the urban population where there's a lot of opposition and Islamists.
Mm-hmm. And so the boycott have a big impact on the perceived legitimacy then of this election?
It did in terms of the overall population. Turnout wasn't minimal. Turnout was around 55-60%. So there were Jordanians who voted in fairly large numbers. But the Islamic Action Front, which is the political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, which commands probably something like a third of the vote, maybe even more than that, approaching 40% or so, a boycott of the election. And so in the eyes of many urbanites, Islamist urbanites, and particularly Palestinian-descended Jordanians who often regarded themselves as disenfranchised, this has not been viewed as a great democracy.
And what's, you know, I think that Jordan is a bit different than some of the other Middle East countries as far as its tendency to protest. Can you talk a little bit about the Jordanian character, so to speak, for background on this?
Yeah, I think that's very important. There are different populations in the Middle East with certain national characters, regional characters. I think some people who aren't familiar with the Middle East tend to look out over the Arab world and presume that it's pretty much same country by country, and it isn't. And very much the old Tip O'Neill expression, all politics local, rules in the Middle East. And Jordanians traditionally are a relatively ordered population who are dismayed by many of the disorderly, disruptive, and violent events that surround them. And in places like Lebanon, the Iraq situation we had for almost a decade, and such as what is going on in Syria right now.
Right.
And so even though this gerrymandering problem goes back to the king's father, King Hussein, in the early 90s, with the same purpose of minimizing the Islamist, quote-unquote, threat. It hasn't produced massive riots or the kind of Arab Spring thing you've seen in other places. There were demonstrations, mind you, back in 2011 and even some in 2012, but not of the same nasty and determined character as some we've seen elsewhere in the Middle East.
And the you met the former king. Can you tell us about that experience?
Oh yes, he was a very modest and respectful person, and I think one thing that shows something about his character in trying to represent himself as an ordinary Jordanian was when he carried the proposal of his son, the current King Abdullah, to the family of the future Queen Rania by going over there himself, driving his own car, asking for her hand from her father in his living room all alone, and giving the usual a gift that accompany a proposal of engagement. And so he does come off one-on-one as a man who, of very rather few vices, and somebody who a lot of Jordanians had respect for, even some who were opponents, and especially the government's main pillar, the tribes.
Right. But there's been somewhat of a disconnection between Rania and the populace and from the Palestinians. Is that right?
Well, not from the Palestinians, because she is Palestinian, but you're right about the tribes. She has engaged in a rather glitzy international lifestyle and spent an immense amount on her 40th birthday, which was fairly recently. And literally a letter was presented to the king on the part of many of the tribes last year, in which they protested her behavior and particularly accused her publicly of corruption in using her influence to pass property and undo contracts, et cetera, to her own Yassin family, the Palestinian Yassin family. There's pushback not only because of her the kind of lifestyle she adopted, but also because she's Palestinian, pure and simple, yeah. And the tribes, in many cases, were uncomfortable with that decision to start with.
And the country's going through a period of austerity. How is that going?
Well, actually, the country is always in a state of austerity, it seems, because Jordan has fewer resources. And it simply can't function like some other states in the region, like Saudi Arabia or Libya, Algeria, countries with hydrocarbon wealth. And so Jordan lives on a lot of foreign aid. Fortunately, it has gotten plenty of international support because it's viewed as a bastion of stability by particularly countries in the West and other modern Arab countries who have the means. And so Jordan is going through a difficult period, but it is not as difficult as it is in some other countries. And the variation from poverty to wealth in Jordan is not as wide as it is in some places like Egypt or Algeria. And so that isn't quite as much a problem. In fact, the king has undertaken a lot of new measures to stimulate the economy through modernizing the economy and liberalizing it and opening it to foreign trade, transparency. And so actually in Jordan as a country has experienced one of the highest rates of growth in the Middle East over the last 5 or 6 years.
I wanted to finally talk about the how Jordan might be affected by what the civil war in Syria. The UN Commission, High Commission on Refugees, says that between 40,000 and 50,000 refugees have fled Syria into Jordan and other areas just this past month. What are the long-term consequences of this, and does it have the potential to be a national crisis?
It could be a potentially national crisis. One problem that, of course, Jordan has is it cannot lavish a lot of spending on these people. In other words, even though she's had a good growth rate, the rise in oil prices and some strains in her economy caused the king to reduce fuel subsidies, which caused a spike in fuel prices, caused some riots and demonstrations just late last year. And what might be coming are electricity subsidies going down because of the rise in price in that. And so part of that results from from instability in Egypt, where natural gas deliveries and whatnot have been erratic. But anyway, so Jordan is not in a position like some other countries of providing as much aid for refugees. So it's terribly dependent on international aid. It hasn't been getting enough. And as you pointed out, the last month has been a real crusher, with the last week having seen over 20,000 refugees coming in.
Well, it's quite a change in the landscape there. I'll be interested in seeing how things play out in the coming months. But we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Joining us today were Wayne White with the Middle East Institute and Glenys Sugarman from Israel's Foreign Press Association. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Mikkel Christensen was our lead producer for this program. Stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Angie Du. Today's news comes from Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Euronews. Last week in Nepal, the ruling Unified Communist Party made death threats to journalists that were protesting during a visit by the Prime Minister to Dalit district. The threats caused 22 journalists to leave the district indefinitely. The journalists worked for the area's daily and weekly newspapers, as well as local radio and television broadcasts. Police in Istanbul jailed at least 11 Turkish journalists to charges of belonging to a banned terrorist group. All of the journalists denied accusations. An Istanbul court released 5 of the journalists the next day, while the others have been imprisoned for yet an undefined period. CPJ reports on the alarming conditions the journalists faced while in custody. They were beaten up by the police and denied access to food or water. With this crackdown, the number of jailed journalists in Turkey rose above 70. Turkey jails more journalists than any other country, ahead of China or Iran. A 29-year-old German female journalist reported to Stern magazine that a male politician made a sexual remark to her last year. This report in Stern has sparked a social media frenzy and has brought the topic of sexism in Germany to the forefront of conversation. Many people wrote blogs that German male politicians are too sexually forward towards female journalists. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Angie Du. See you next week.